And now it's time for another diminutive episode of the Rish...
Fake Sean.
Out. Cached. Are you sure diminutive is the word that you're looking for? Certainly. As in, Rish's is rather diminutive. Touché. Hey, folks. This is Rish Outfield, and you are listening to the Rish Outcast. And for some reason, I forgot to record the introduction to this episode. Hence, it is late. I wish we could refer to you as the late Rish Outfield. All right. That is fair. Today, we are going to do the second half of the story. Don't you remember its name? I don't. Really? Is it Never Let Him Go? Is it? You still don't know? I'm gonna go with yes. Never Let Him Go. I wish I could let you go. Yeah, you just can't quit me, huh?
So, in 2020, the year that I wrote this story and recorded this episode, I wrote a number of Dead and Breakfast stories in a row. I did write other things in between sometimes, but immersing myself in that particular world gave me ideas for all sorts of other stories, some of which I wrote and some of which I never did write. And this is Rish Outfield from the future talking now. I'm in 2023, amazingly enough. And I didn't have any episodes, just like I said, in 2020, I didn't have any episodes ready to go. And I'm deep in the middle of a big audiobook project, and I thought, I'm not sure what to do. But I need to keep putting out episodes, right? Keep the momentum going. Maybe it's just greed. Not sure. But I saw that I had this episode from back then, and I never put it out. Around this time, I had put out the Fatherless Child episode, which was just for Patreon supporters. And I think I figured I would release this one, you know, at the end of the year or maybe early 2021, but I never did. And so here we are in 2023, and I've been writing Laura and the Witch stories. And it's so strange how when you're surrounded by these characters, you are curious about things, or somebody will say a line and you'll say, you know, that gives me an idea for this, or, oh, I wonder what happened after this. Anyhow, I'm doing the same thing now that I was doing then, but instead of it being Dead and Breakfast stories, it's Laura and the Witch stories. It reminded me of how exciting that was. That was something that I had not experienced before because I hadn't been doing the regimented writing every single day to that extent. And of course, as you remember, the pandemic threw everything into confusion. People weren't going to movies. People weren't going on vacations. Well, you know, some people did. People weren't going to concerts, weren't going to dances. Well, some people did, right? But for the most part, you were stuck. And there were fewer options. Do you remember that stretch when even grocery stores and fast food restaurants were really hesitant to open their doors and we were all just so afraid? It was not long ago, but sometimes it seems like long ago because it was such an upheaval of our society. I just realized that I'm making this episode even longer. But that's what we want, right? You did not tune into one of my shows for brevity. I hope that the people who enjoy my show enjoy that aspect of it. That you're never going to get a 28-minute long episode. Not anymore. Anyhow, I am going to run the story now. And then afterward, I will talk a little bit about the story, but I encourage you, if you have not read the Dead and Breakfast stories that I've put out there, to seek them out. And one day I am going to sit down and do a collection of the first 8 or 9 and I'll put them all together and I'll put out an audio version of all of those. And maybe you can buy that too, especially if you're listening to this later in the year. It might be available. Remind me if it's not, okay? So I depend on you guys sometimes to keep me straight. That sounds strange, doesn't it? Okay, let's say it this way. To keep me on the straight and narrow. No, that sounds strange too. To keep my eye on the ball. All right, with no further ado, here is the second half of Never Let Him Go by me.
Never Let Him Go by Rish Outfield. The second weekend in July, Natalie Whitmore looked in on Mason after she clocked in. He was in the employee lounge, filling in some kind of sheet Mrs. Bice had made him write up to explain his absence at work early on the 3rd, while he'd been talking to the police. She had not asked Natalie to make up or excuse any lost time due to the authorities. Mason didn't realize she was there, and had a peaceful, almost monk-like expression on his face as he finished up the paperwork. He'd either lost weight or put on muscle since she'd last really looked at him. He wasn't quite fit exactly, but he was closer to it every day. And his Spanish had improved so much, she wondered if he hadn't been pretending all this time, as an excuse to spend time with her. Guys had tried such tactics before. But no, she recognized that his language skills were just like his healthier look, a result of dedication and practice. She wished, for the first time ever, that she could look at him the way he obviously looked at her. Mason seemed to have found a purpose in life, a reason for getting up in the morning, and it rhymed, sort of, with rattly. Not that she didn't have a lot going on in her life, and reason to get up when or before her alarm went off. Guys were always coming around. Some of them coyly, some of them bluntly, some with pie-in-the-sky intentions, and some just wanting to spend the night. And she had good friends, although, to be truthful, there were fewer of them around than she once had, now that the girls were getting married and the guys were giving up. But Natalie had always been like that. The first time she'd been hit on by a grown man was when she was 13. And it hadn't really let up since then. Guys were easy. It was girls that were harder to win over. She suspected that a lot of them were jealous, and many had come right out and said so. But there were a handful of loyal, evergreen friends to keep her going on the few occasions she felt lonely. More than she wished she could love Mason, she wished that he were just another one of the girls, and they could be pals, both here at work and after. True, they didn't have a great deal in common. She was the youngest of 7. He was an only child. He lived through books and comics, while she hadn't read a book not assigned by school since trying, unsuccessfully, to get into Twilight when she was in middle school. He'd been a nerd who played the coronet, whatever that was, while she had been a cheerleader. For only a year, but that sort of thing went on your permanent record, like the song said. But she liked something about him that sure would have gone a long way had he been a she. The one time he had gotten the courage up, and it really had been sweet, to ask her to continue the Spanish lessons outside of work, she'd turned him down.
"I don't date people I work with, Mason. Always been a rule."
I wasn't, he tried to lie.
It wouldn't be a date. Just a Spanish lesson, you know? Heck, we could do it over the phone.
But you said over lunch.
Because we both work at dinner time.
His face was red, and she could feel something. Humiliation or just typical embarrassment, radiating off him like a sunburn.
If it helps, I'd insist you pay.
It was an admirable attempt. But she shook her head.
Better not. Sorry.
She had looked forward to whatever he'd say next, to see if his second try was stronger or weaker than his first. But he had only wilted and said,
Right, yeah, no problem.
He'd never brought it up again. And normally that would not bother Natalie in the slightest. The men she found attractive were the ones confident enough to keep some of their cards hidden, to play it, if not disinterested, then at least somewhat casual. Desperation was the worst look in a guy. She'd thought that even in the school dance days. But she wondered if she shouldn't have let Mason take her out anyway. Reward him for getting the difference between ser and estar, which even Spanish teachers rarely pulled off. A good policy, he'd said a minute later. And she'd had no idea what he was referring to.
What is?
Not to date guys at work.
Oh.
She wanted to hear his reasoning, though there was still something wounded in his voice. Mrs. Bice had told her he was in love with her, rather than just harboring a crush or a simple hard-on. And somehow, that nasty old woman had been right. He made a circle with his hand. Because things could be awkward around the office, if it don't work out.
Exactly, she said. If it don't work out?
It's from an old song. Johnny Mathis or somebody. Around that time, the trouble with the police had started. A guest had killed himself on the night of the hauntings, and a second one had disappeared from his room, without a trace. The police had been over, 50 times since then. And to Natalie's surprise, Mrs. Bice had been angry about it. Angry at the cops, and especially angry at Mason. She'd taken him to task for calling the police first instead of calling her, despite it being 5 in the morning. According to Mason, he'd been aware of the time before he called and woke her, but felt like a death was important enough to bother her at home with the news. The owner of the bed and breakfast hadn't arrived until nearly 7, which was when Mason was supposed to go home and get some sleep. By the time everybody was done questioning him, he was more emotionally exhausted than he was physically tired. It was an exhausting place, on that one night a year at least.
¿Qué tal, Mason?
She asked, stepping up to him, though not too close.
About 5'10", he said,
then grinned goofily.
¿Qué tal means what? How's it going? Algo así, she said,
then helped him out.
Something like that.
Estoy bien. ¿Y tú?
Bien. ¿Quieres practicar hoy con alguien que realmente hable español?
He didn't understand the question. She explained that Pilar, who came in every morning to do laundry, had agreed to speak with him, since her English was about on the same level as his Spanish. She told him it would be fun. And, well, it wasn't a complete disaster. But it wasn't any fun. He wanted to show Natalie he could do it, but learning another language is hard. And while Pilar fawned over how well he was speaking it with her, they both knew she was just being nice. When she spoke Spanish to him, he understood every third word, even missing the ones that he would have gotten had Natalie been speaking them. He took it badly, but promised to keep trying, which Natalie admired. There was a lot to admire about Mason. She'd discovered he liked to draw, and had recreated, from memory, the east side of the manor house, where it looked like it had in the 40s, rather than the slapdash expansion that had corrupted the other side of the building. He had installed some app on his phone that was supposed to teach you another language in 6 weeks, but was really designed to get you to pay if you wanted to use it more than 15 minutes a day.
Don't get down, she advised him. You already speak it better than 90% of Americans.
Surely more than 10% of America speaks Spanish.
You know? I don't know, she said.
He hesitated and said, "Thanks again for helping me out on this, man. You didn't have to." It was only the 100th time he'd thanked her, but every time had been sincere.
"Did you just call me man?"
The way the light hit your face, it was like..." And he trailed off.
"What? It was like what?"
He shrugged. "I was going to say it was like the start of a beard. I didn't want to hurt your feelings." She wanted to roll her eyes, but didn't.
"That's all right. I always have some 5 o'clock shadow going around this time each day."
"You do not," he said, affronted. And that was funnier than his attempt at humor had been. He wouldn't, apparently, stand for any criticism of Natalie's beauty, even from herself. Natalie changed the subject.
"Hey, did you used to work with a lady called Michelle or Michelle?"
"Where? At the hotel?"
"The bed and breakfast, yeah."
"No. Michelle? Not Michelle."
"Might have been, but she said it weird. Seems like there was a Backstreet Boys song that went, 'My Michelle,' I heard once."
He narrowed his eyebrows. "Backstreet Boys. You sure it wasn't the Beatles?"
"Same difference," she said,
and steeled herself for his attack. But he laughed instead. "Yeah, the boys were pretty great. They changed the face of music forever."
"Anyway, this lady called. Said she used to work here, doing what we do."
"How long ago?"
"Didn't say. Anyway, she was asking for Mrs. Bice. I didn't know if I dared give her cell number out or not."
"You didn't, did you?" Mason asked, aware that Constance Bice would probably consider that a hanging offense, much less a firing one.
"No, just told her when she'd be in."
Natalie hesitated, not wanting to mention that she was afraid that the lady had been calling about a job opening. His job. Instead, she said,
"She said something funny to me. She said, 'You've been working here long, long enough to see some things.' And I told her, 'Yes, but it's not something I'm supposed to talk about.'"
Mason swallowed. Again, if this had been some troublemaker in the employ of Mrs. Bice, Natalie could have lost her job saying that sort of thing. "And she said?"
"She said, 'If you make friends with them, you might see them all the time.'"
"All the time? What does that mean?"
"I don't know. I guess she really did work here, before our time."
Natalie now wished she hadn't brought it up. If Mrs. Bice was hiring again, then that meant Mason's days were numbered. And Natalie surprised herself by being disappointed when he didn't ask her out again. It was not that she wanted to go out with him, or even for him to continue to pursue her, but she liked men who had a little fight in them, who didn't back away from difficulties or challenges, and she knew a lot of other women liked that as well. Of course, there were girls that liked the quiet, longing, sensitive type that Mason was, too. Maybe he could find one of them, and soon. But she'd still have liked him to show a little backbone, just for his own sake. But his dedication to learning a second language was both impressive and attractive to her. He poured into it completely, even going so far as to, according to him, watching versions of his favorite movies with the Spanish-dubbed tracks on, trying to really get his head around the language. He'd gotten better the next time they practiced with Pilar from laundry. "Hola, Pilar. Me llama Mason," he said, which was an almost totally correct way of saying hello and his name.
"Eres el que encontró al hombre ahogado," she said.
He had no clue what she was asking, but knew eres and hombre meant you are and man.
"Ahogado means drowned,"
Natalie whispered to him. But she'd made the mistake of leaning in and lightly rubbing against him, and whatever Spanish he used to know immediately left his brain.
"Man drowned?"
he asked her, then looked back at Pilar.
"Sí, hombre ahogado."
Pilar smiled at that. She seemed nice.
You find him?
Mason understood then.
Me? Yeah, I was...
And Natalie elbowed him, gently, but good.
Si, encontro hombre.
¡Qué escándalo!
The woman exclaimed, which Mason didn't really understand, but took to mean, what a shame. His cheeks were reddening, though, and Natalie saw his body language change. She hadn't seen the man's dead body that night, but Mason had described it as being something he hoped he could forget one day.
Y era un actor o pastor, ¿no?
Natalie said something to the woman, and Mason thought it translated to, let's talk to him about something else. He must have been right, because the woman began to ask him where he was from and how old he was and what time he got to work that day. He didn't do well, but both of them encouraged him anyway. You couldn't just learn a new language overnight, try as he might. Pilar went home from her shift, leaving the two of them together.
What was that she was asking you about there at the end?
Mason asked. He had caught the word for dancing and the word for girlfriend, but very little in between.
Nothing. She just asked me about some club she used to go to. Said her brother would take me.
Mason nodded. He'd have to take her word for it, but not being able to understand had bothered him. Just like the idea of Natalie going out dancing made him long to be there too, there were just some things in life that bothered him.
I'm sorry she brought up the dead guy,
she said. No, I get it. It's a, you know, morbid curiosity.
You still think about him?
She asked. Natalie had seen the body, covered with a sheet or tarp, as paramedics wheeled it out through the lobby that morning. She had never asked if the suicide had been clothed or naked when he drowned himself. She didn't know which would be worse.
Sometimes, yeah. I'll be eating or driving, and I'll just see his face.
He sniffed, and she knew, just knew, he was going to make some kind of joke about it.
It was kind of the opposite of yours.
I'll take that as a compliment, I think.
I'm just glad it was me that found him,
he said, which was an almost shockingly awful statement. Why on earth would anyone be glad to have...
Instead of you, he added quietly.
She wanted to hold him then. Just one person comforting another person, with nothing romantic and or sexual about it. But she didn't dare do it, knowing he'd probably take it the wrong way. She blamed Mrs. Bice, telling her Mason was in love with her, likening him to a dog, she seemed to recall, making her feel she had to do all she could not to lead him on. And Natalie had had her own encounter with a dead person that same night, and her corpse had been walking around, dripping phantom blood all over the carpet and front desk. She'd never told Mason about it, despite him telling her quite a bit about his ghostly interactions.
"Do you think his spirit haunts this place now?"
she asked.
"Who, the game show guy?"
"The man that killed himself, yeah."
"You know, I bet it does. He's probably here in the lobby somewhere, watching us talk about him."
She felt uneasy about it, but made a joke anyway.
"Hopefully he's not watching us on the toilet."
"We'd better go with the lights off, just in case,"
he said. But there was still that, no pun intended, haunted expression on his face. Natalie tried to cheer him up, telling him about a video her friend had put on TikTok, which had gotten over 10,000 views. He told her she should do that too, but the conversation eventually petered out. After a while, a big group of people arrived, in town for a family reunion, and they were too busy to be awkward. Mason got better at the language, but it ultimately didn't make a difference. Mrs. Bice was waiting for him on a Wednesday night shift. She hadn't asked anyone to stay longer so she could talk to him, and it was a short conversation.
"Have you been smoking?"
"Me? No, I don't smoke."
The old woman narrowed her eyes behind her glasses.
I've seen you smoke.
The day we met, he said, reeling that she still remembered that. Over a year ago. I've never smoked here. I quit.
From your mouth, Mason.
Something he'd said amused her a little bit, but he didn't pick up on it.
I understand you think you speak Spanish now.
No, but I will. I'm getting there.
Why are you doing that? So you can spend time with her?
The emphasis she put on her was somehow both petty and unnecessarily judgmental. That might have something to do with it, Mason said, and smiled his charmingest. He thought about Natalie when he went to sleep at night, and she was the first thing on his mind when he woke up, if it was a good day. But no, I wanted you to see that I was serious about this job, about becoming a more valuable employee, I guess. Bice was not impressed.
Even so, I'll probably bring in someone new. And I'll have to cut back one or two of your shifts once they get here.
Mason's face became a little harder. If that's what you have to do, I understand. I'm going to get better with the Spanish, though. Mrs. Bice may have been impressed by that, but she didn't say so.
No more overtime. Not ever, you understand? If you're covering another shift, you'll need to have them clear it with me before you can say yes.
All right, he said, and it came out as though it didn't bother him.
Okay, go get started. The water can needs to be changed tonight.
Mason didn't thank her, as was his usual wont. He didn't dare call her Connie anymore, either. She had been, when he was first hired, like a matronly aunt. Now she was like an old librarian or a truancy cop, always looking for excuses to bust him. When he next saw Natalie, his Spanish was no better, despite being able to quote Gandalf in Fellowship, proclaiming what his titles were and why she would not pass.
How long did it take you to memorize that? She asked.
Not too long. No more than 100 times. She smiled, not that it was funny, but at his earnestness. And when she smiled, he smiled. Remember when you said you had a policy? About not dating guys from work? A nod.
Well, that might not be a problem anymore, he said.
And though she was still smiling, it looked pasted on now.
Silver lining, eh? What did she say?
He told her. Natalie grimaced. She found herself extremely angry at Mrs. Bice, and unusually close to Mason at that moment. Again, she had to refrain from touching him.
You know, she told me once that she was going to fire you. I'm sorry I never said anything.
When was this?
Around the ghost night. Thing is, she looks harmless, but I think she's the boss from The Devil Wears Prada.
Was that the one that wanted a fur coat made from a bunch of dogs?
I don't remember, Natalie admitted. I fell asleep halfway through.
Oh, you missed the ending then. When the girl kills her boss and makes a fur coat out of her.
She's not going to fire you, Mason. We'll practice Spanish till you speak it better than me. Better than... I can't think of any Mexican actors right now.
Well, the Modern Family woman. She's a good one.
I think she's from Colombia or Guatemala or something.
He sighed. Boy, I wish I was, if that's the way they grow 'em down there. And again, not all that funny a joke, but Natalie laughed anyway. And when she laughed, he smiled again, and they both shared a moment of warm human interaction. They were genuinely friends now, instead of whatever they'd been before. They kept practicing, and she looked forward to it, even being disappointed by her weeknight shifts, when she didn't share the front desk with Mason. try as he might, and some of the cleaning staff claimed Mason's Spanish had gotten más o menos bien, which he thought meant pretty good, Mrs. Bice's mind was made up. She was waiting for him again on Monday, and said, "Follow me," as she went into the break room. Mason looked around desperately for another clerk. Most embarrassingly, Natalie Whitmore, who might have been asked to cover for his final shift. But there was nobody. As he went into the lounge, the owner sitting in the chair by the table, he squared his shoulders and decided to take it like a man. He had had a good run in this job, met some cool people, fallen in love, más o menos bien, and found out that ghosts were real. He'd also been bored out of his mind a few dozen times, went home with a tired back, read a few books he wasn't interested in, and surfed the internet at least 1,000 hours, not to mention finding the body of a rather horrific suicide. But he was determined that, looking back, he would only remember the good stuff, from the look of gratitude in the faces of guests who'd experienced something special, to that slightly chocolatey smell Natalie's hair sometimes had, though he never knew exactly what that was. This had been a good job, but one that had never really had room for growth or advancement. He sat down.
"Mr. Bradley, I'll get right to the point. A couple of your co-workers have spoken up for you, particularly the immigrant ones, reminding me of what a fine job they think you do here, and it is appreciated."
"Really?" Mason thought, wondering why the old bat had stressed the word immigrant so hard. "Are you capable of appreciation?" he wondered.
"But I have hired on another young man. His name is Lawrence, though he actually goes by Lauren, if you can believe that. He's a handsome, outgoing boy, a people person."
"All the things I'm not, in other words," thought Mason. But his expression didn't change. Hers did, though. She wrinkled up her nose, as if he'd just farted out week-old enchiladas.
"Have you been smoking?"
He tried not to raise his voice. Was she really going to go there? Make that her invented excuse? "I don't smoke, Mrs. Bice." She took that in the worst possible way, naturally.
"Of course you do. I smell it as surely as..."
She looked away from him, toward the door to the employee parking lot at the end of the break room. Now Mason smelled it, too. It wasn't just a cigarette smell, but a stale, overflowing ashtray stink, somehow brown-smelling. It did seem to be coming from just beyond those doors.
"What the hellfire?"
the old woman breathed, then popped to her feet like a jack-in-the-box. She didn't excuse herself or tell Mason to wait for her. Instead, she stalked, Terminator-style, across the room and out the doors. God help any employee who was out there smoking. Mason snorted, bitterly. "Indeed, God help us all." He was alone in the room now, and the phone at the main desk began to ring. Should he get it? Was that even his job anymore? He was aware that Bice had a meticulous file on him, and surely she'd have carted that out to read aloud if this was his last day. No, she'd probably relish that, do it on a day when this square-jawed Adonis she'd just hired was at the desk answering the phone for him. More humiliating that way, right? The phone kept ringing. Mrs. Bice hadn't returned, and Mason...
"Oh," he said aloud. "I get it."
And he laughed.
It wasn't completely humorless,
but about 80%. He got up and left the room. The phone was still ringing at the desk. Nobody at all was in the lobby. He picked up the phone.
"Guys, I appreciate what you're doing. I really do. But her mind is made up. If you..."
"Hello, is this the bed and breakfast?"
a male, non-ghostly voice interrupted. Mason looked down at the caller ID, It was an outside number, one with the same area code, 208, as theirs.
Hey, yes. I'm sorry about that. This is Mason. How can I help you?
Look, I've got to get on a plane, but I needed to get a message to Constance Beast. My name is Lauren Beckstead. She offered me a job there to do overnights. I had a thing happened, and it looks like I'm in Europe for the next 6 months.
In the background, he could hear a loudspeaker announcement saying,
"Now boarding at gate 12.
Sorry, Mason said, for something to say.
"Oh, no, it's all good. Something I didn't think could happen, but it did. Good news, believe me."
The guy cleared his throat, and Mason imagined a Ken doll standing by a flight terminal, maybe one wearing an ascot.
"Anyhow, I'm sorry to leave her in the lurch like this. Could you leave her the message for me that I'm real sorry, but I can't take the job?"
Mason shook his head. "No, I can't, man. But let me transfer you to her voicemail, and you can say all this again."
"Oh,"
the guy said, and there was definitely annoyance there. He couldn't understand that Bice had to hear it from the new hire, not from him. Or she might fire him anyway, just to take out her frustrations on somebody else.
"Well, I really gotta go."
"Thanks for understanding, Lauren," he said, and hit the hold button, then did the transfer. As soon as the call had gone through, Mason looked around him, wondering who might be listening. "Was this you? Can you really do stuff like this? Or is it just a coincidence?" Of course they didn't answer him, but he wondered how many of them were there now, maybe watching him. Did they watch him when he picked his nose at 3:45 a.m. on a slow shift, or stepped into the bathroom for a 15-minute sit-down? Well, if they did, they seemed to like him anyway.
"I like you guys too," he said.
He heard the employee door closing in the break room and tried not to be smug. When Bice rejoined him, she was in a foul mood. Fouler than usual, which was saying something.
"Did you find them?"
Mason asked.
"No, I did not. But I heard them, whoever it was, skipping about out there, just around the corner. I even saw the smoke when I got to the east side of the building. You know, I thought I saw a kid run past when I came through to answer the phone. Teenager, it looked like." "Nasty things," she muttered. "You know, when I was a girl, Noble Oaks didn't allow children of any kind. Except me, of course. It was a fine rule my parents had, but it made for a lonely upbringing."
"Did you play with ghosts?" he wanted to ask, but thought better of it.
"Hey, somebody called just now. Said they would leave you a voicemail." "You didn't take a message?" she asked.
And there it was. Any excuse to read him the riot act.
"They said it was personal. Sorry."
Bice sucked on her inner lip for a moment. Her nostrils flared. He got the impression she was as angry at him as she was at her phantom chain smoker.
"I'd better check that out before I go," she said. "You wait for me here."
"Will do," he said cheerfully.
"Too cheerfully?"
"Probably." She gave him the evil eye and went slowly down the aisle toward her office, moving much more laboredly than she had gone after her perpetrator before. Mason ran his fingers over the desk, shook the mouse on the login computer so it would wake up, put his Robin Hobb paperback back in his drawer, and touched Natalie's drawer with his index finger while he waited for the owner to return. He definitely felt someone watching him now.
"Thanks, guys," he told the room. "Let me know if I can help you out with anything."
After a few minutes, Constance Bice came out again, and her face was, well, it looked pale, actually, like a goose had walked over her grave.
"Keep doing your job, Mason. Just try to have a better attitude and be professional. We'll talk again some other time."
Then she walked away, not waiting for his reply, her back bent with the weight of the cruel disappointment she must be feeling right now. Good night, he called, and did his best not to sound like he was smiling. The end.
All right. Well, there you are. The entire story this time of Never Let Him Go.
I don't know that that comes from a song. It's, you know, Never Let Me Go.
I don't know!
Is where it's coming from. But it's a play on words because letting someone go can also mean firing them from their job. Did I have to explain that? You got that, right?
I don't know about that.
But I was on the fence about presenting this one, and I was also on the fence about doing an episode for Fatherless Child, because both of those stories seemed really expendable, shall we say? They seemed like they weren't required reading, if you will. You know, this is a series about a haunted bed and breakfast, and one night of the year, everybody that stays the night there gets a knock on the door and a ghost appears. Somebody that has a connection with them. And this is the first story that I wrote that doesn't take place then, that doesn't include that. And I just last week sat down and I recorded Never Let Him Go. And I got to the end and I felt like, oh, well, that's less significant than I remember it being. Huh. And it sort of bummed me out. Because even though I wrote it just this year, I wrote it 9 months ago, I remembered it being more significant than that, if you will. And then, 2 or 3 days ago, I was doing a search through my emails, looking for things that I email to myself. One thing that I always do every time I go to the library is I open up Gmail, my account there, and then I'll open up a Word document, a new document usually. And then when I'm done writing for the day, I will email myself the document that I wrote. And that way, it's super easy for me to keep track of how many words I wrote that day. But these are a bunch of separate Word files. When I did You're in Good Hands, the second Laura and the Witch book, every single day was another one of these trips to the library. And then putting them all together was like putting a puzzle together. And you would think that every single day you just do it in chronological order and everything would be great. But I didn't always go to the library. And I didn't always pick up where I left off. And I remember that taking me a couple of hours just to organize. Anyhow, this one, so I was doing a search and I discovered a file that said, Never Let Me Go, so-and-so day. And I thought, so-and-so day, what does that mean? And I opened the file and it was scenes from the story that I hadn't recorded, that hadn't been part of the audio that I had done when I just the week before when I was doing the audio version of it. And I was relieved because I thought, oh, okay, well, no wonder it felt so underwhelming. So a lot of what was missing was the middle of the story, the stuff with Natalie teaching Mason Spanish and talking about the dead guy and the two of them spending time together and then like her point of view. All that the first story was just the interviews with Mrs. Bice and Mason. And then when he first asked Natalie to help him with the Spanish. And if you didn't like the story, then, you know, the middle bit isn't going to make you like it. But if you did like the story, I think the middle bit is what makes you like it. Because that's the meat, as opposed to maybe the bread, which is the it's a bad metaphor. I don't know why I'm telling you that.
I don't know.
As I said at the very beginning, when I wrote The Night Clerk, I fell in love with these two characters, Mason Bradley and Natalie Whitmore, I mean, I don't know if love is the best word for it. I just really enjoyed writing their dynamic, and I had left stuff unfinished. And so when I went back to Touching the Other Side and finished that story, which, you know, ultimately became the third story rather than the second story, I inserted Natalie and Mason retroactively into that story and made it so that it was the same night as The Night Clerk ends on, and that was a blast. That was liberating. It was just something new as a writer that I hadn't experienced before, and I loved it. And I remember talking to Abigail Hilton. Thank you. Where she was talking about her characters, because she will write, she has these characters that are in the Panamandora universe, and she goes back to them again and again. And something that she would do for her Patreon supporters is that she would write a story that featured, like, a solo adventure or the backstory of one of the characters from her books, and she would let her Patreon supporters vote on it. Anyhow, that's a long way around me saying that she told me that she knew all of these details about her characters. They were alive for her. They were vivid characters. And I didn't have characters like that. I didn't feel that. Except for with Ben Parks, with the Sidekick Chronicles stories, which was really the only series that I had when we had this conversation. And even then, I wasn't doing that much with it. So suddenly, writing about Natalie Whitmore, Mason Bradley, Constance Bice, I finally understood what Abigail was talking about. Is that old? Should I stop doing that? And there were things that I wanted to tell, and there were things that I wanted to develop with these two characters. Oh, you know, before, when I was talking about the Dead and Breakfast series, I didn't mention Three-Time Visitor. And I wrote Three-Time Visitor before I wrote Never Let Him Go. But when I was writing the first two or three stories, four stories, about those two, I fully intended for Mason and Natalie to fall in love somewhere along the line, or for Natalie to warm to Mason and for them to be a couple. And in the story, Three-Time Visitor, it takes place over three different visits to the bed and breakfast. And in the third visit, Natalie and Mason were going to be together. The first visit is before Natalie is hired. We get to meet Mason before she is hired. The second visit is the same night as Night Clerk and Touching the Other Side take place on. And so we get to see the two of them, how they interact. And then the third night was going to be months later, and they were a couple. And when I got to that third night, they weren't a couple. Do you know what I mean by that? You'll hear authors talk about their characters surprising them a lot. Their characters having a life of their own, their characters fighting them, or whatever you want to say. And it always seems like an oversimplification or, you know, silliness or whatever, but that definitely happened with these two. Mason is a good guy, and he deserves to be happy. And I just figured, well, you know, it's fiction, so why can he not be with the girl that he loves? But it didn't work out. And here we are. I have four or five stories since then, and they're still not together, although I have had them get closer. And this story has the bit where Natalie is looking at Mason and wishing that he were a girl because she likes him. He's a good guy. It's like When Harry Met Sally says, you know, the sex thing is always going to get in the way. And that's definitely the case with these two. I've written it over and over and over again, and stop me if I ever write a story where it doesn't happen. But Natalie is drawn to Mason. She wants to put her arms around him or hug him or kiss him or, you know, just hang out with him. But she doesn't do it because
She knows that he has romantic feelings for her, and she doesn't have those same romantic feelings for him. And it's a huge stumbling block to a relationship between a man and a woman. There was a girl that a coworker that I had on my team at the job that I had when I lived in Los Angeles. And we were like a little, I'm not gonna say family, but it was kind of like that. You know, like we were friends because we were a team. We were all on the same team and we would, you know, occasionally, this Friday, let's get together. The team can get together to eat dinner or whatever. And I felt like that was really neat. And we would work together, you know, for common goals. And so it did feel a little bit like a family. And one of the girls on my team, she was really young. And she invited the rest of us to her birthday party. And I think it was a Sunday afternoon. She says, you know, here's my address. I want you guys all to come to my birthday party. And I was really surprised by this because that didn't happen much with me. I mean, it never happens now, but it back then I was just like, wow, somebody invited me to their birthday party. And I don't really know her, but she's on my team at work. And so I went out and I got her a present. It was a small little thing, like a $10 thing, you know. And I went to her birthday party and I was the only one from work that showed up. And I found out later that it's like, well, none of us were going to go to her birthday party because we're a team at work. We're office friends, but we're not friends. And you got her a present? And people were surprised by that because I had overstepped something. And maybe I'm oversimplifying here too, but the girl, we'll call her Martha.
Why did you say that name?
Because that was her name. She took it in a very, very different way because I was the only one from our team that went to her house and met her parents and got her a present. And that doesn't paint the Dead and Breakfast series. It's not influenced by this experience, except for... It's when I found out how that works. I had given her the wrong idea, I suppose, by overstepping. And so maybe that niggles at the back of my mind because Natalie and Mason have this friendship and they work together. And also, you know, they have these supernatural experiences, which are a big deal. And that tends to bring people together, right? So, you know, the fact that he is so into her, that he worships the ground she walks on, he really does. It impedes the closeness, the level of closeness that they can get together. Does that make sense? And maybe it doesn't have to make sense. That's just how it is. I suppose it's still possible, if Mason and Natalie worked together for years, that they could get together. That one day she could just look at him and she sees something that she didn't see before. Or, you know, she's having a hard day. She's stressed out and he's there. And she's just like, oh, you know what? What the heck? Let's go for it. Relationships are so hard. And I don't know thing one or thing two. I don't know the Cat in the Hat about relationships. But you never know what sort of things are going to happen. The point of this story was to resolve that plot line in Night Clerk where Mason is going to be fired. And so, you know, I just had the ghosts help. And I liked that. I liked the idea that they took a role and it made later on when the ghosts become more active, it was a stepping stone. It helped me get to that point where it's like, yeah, the ghosts know Mason. They know that they can trust Mason. And he has learned to trust them. So this is Rish from the future again, justifying or trying to justify why he split the episode in two. And maybe it was the right choice, maybe it wasn't. But it's the decision that I made. And you can tie that to writing as well. You know, I've heard it said that acting is all about choices. And that certainly seems to be the case when I do my narration, the one that I'm doing now for The Cormorant, which is a very large book and a very daunting project. Whenever I do the math to see where I am in the process, how close I am to being done, a part of me shudders because it's a very large project. But I can do it. That has nothing to do with what I was just saying. Writing is it's a different process. It uses a different part of my brain to write than it does to narrate. And when I narrate my own work, like this story, sometimes I am surprised because I'm looking at it with different eyes. I'm looking at it with the eyes of a narrator rather than the eyes of a writer. And you've heard me say this maybe more than anything other than I don't know. Always read your work aloud because it feels different. It sounds, the words have a rhythm when you speak them aloud that they don't have when you read it in your mind. And you notice things that you didn't notice before. Tense changes, you notice unnecessary words or more likely missing words. And in your head, you fill in those missing words. But when you read it aloud, you catch them. You discover uses of the same word over and over again that your mind filters out when you're reading it silently. But also, there is this experience that I have had of unfamiliarity where I don't remember writing something, even if it was something as recently as last year or 2 years ago. And I feel like that is either early onset adult dementia, or it is that I go somewhere. My mind accesses different parts of my brain when I write, almost as though it's translating rather than creating. As though maybe the story was already there and I'm trying to reiterate it. Now, that's not always the case. There are definitely times where you stare at the screen and nothing is staring back at you, and you have to force, you have to strain and ultimately just make a decision of where it's going to go. And sometimes those decisions are wrong. But it is an unusual process. And I wonder if musicians who write songs go to that same place in their mind, and you ask Bob Dylan, well, why this word or why this rhyme? And he'll say, sorry. He doesn't remember. He doesn't know why he chose that stuff. It seemed to be flowing. It seemed to be something that he was trying to catch rather than create. Your mileage may vary, of course, but as I have said, I've written a lot of these, and if you like them, I can always run another one on the show, or more importantly, I can always put out more that nobody has ever read. You know, the ones that I have finished but never released. And then along those same lines, I could write more Dead and Breakfast stories. At this point in 2023, I'm so far removed from then. This was late 2020 when I recorded this episode. I was trying to figure out exactly when it was, and I
couldn't figure out whether it was November or December. There's no point where I say, last night I went and saw this or whatever. And in those days, I was blogging every single day. And so that sort of thing would be easy where I'd be like, oh, okay, when did I go see that? But the mindset I was in when I was writing those stories, where I was sort of immersed in that world and I saw a face in my mind whenever I mentioned Mason or Michelle or, you know, one of these characters, that has receded. And when I was doing the 2023 parts of this episode, I really had to struggle to remember the characters' names. There was one part where I started talking about the characters and there were lots of uhs. And eventually I just cut out all the uhs and made it sound like, you know, all the characters rather than all the characters. Like Natalie Whitmore and, you know, the guy, you know, kind of thing. That is very strange to me as well. But I feel like it's all related. It's all related to where you go when you are writing, when you are creating, when you are tapping into this part of your brain that maybe doesn't get used all the time. So one last little thing. I give a lot of advice, right, when it comes to writing. You've heard a lot of it in this episode and the one before. And the best advice is always read it aloud, but there's other bits of advice that I can give. And one of those pieces of advice that I've never given you before is when you have something traumatic happen to you, when you have something heartbreaking happen to you, when you have something wonderful and unexpected happen to you, when you lose somebody, when you gain somebody, when something remarkable happens in your life, write about it. Either incorporate it into something that you're writing, blog about it, journal about it, write poetry, write about the way that you feel. Because, believe me, you won't always remember how that felt quite so vividly. It won't be everything that's going through your head. It won't be instantly accessible. As the years go by, our love will never die. Sorry. As the years go by, you'll have to search and try and remember how you felt about something. But if you write about it when it happens, it's better, it's stronger, and there will be details that you won't remember that you forgot. This is actually related to Never Let Him Go. So Constance Bice, the owner of the Bed and Breakfast, is based on the boss that I had when I came up with the very first Bed and Breakfast story, which was called True Ghost Encounter. And she was not a good lady, not a good person, really, not a great boss, but, you know, she did have a couple of positive qualities that I commented upon when I first met her, but those qualities were few and far between, and her negative qualities were really, really strong. And my mom is one of those people that just likes everybody. Oh, there's good people everywhere you go, don't you know? She's from Mexico, she's not from Minnesota, but she is from the Minnesota of Mexico. She likes everybody, and she did not like that woman. Anyhow, I based I based Mrs. Bice off of her and things that she said, things that she did. And I hadn't thought of Never Let Me Go in a couple of years. But as I was editing it, there's the part where she says, come into my office, Mason, close the door. And that was based on an experience that I had with her, where she took me aside and acted like she needed my help with something. And I said, well, you know, I'm working right now. If you can give me a minute. And then I asked the guy that was supposed to go home if he could cover while I talked to her. And he says, oh yeah, I'm here for the rest of the day. And I said, no, you're off at 3 or whatever time it was. And he goes, no, she asked me to stay. That should have been like a huge clue as to what was coming. But I didn't get it. I was just like, oh, okay, well, that's great, man. I'll talk to you in just a few minutes. I got to finish. I got to do something and I'll come talk to you. Anyway, so she invited me into her office and then she said, close the door. And I'd heard close the door before. You know me. I've been fired so many times from so many jobs that right there should have been clue number 2, that this is my last day. But I was still under this impression that she was asking me to help her with something. It's funny how dumb I was in retrospect. And it goes on and on from that, where I didn't realize I was being fired until about halfway through the meeting. You know, in my mind, I guess it was like an impromptu, one of those little meetings that you have with HR, you have with your boss to look at how you've done over the last year with goals and all of that stuff. I guess I figured it was something like that, but it was not. And what's funny is that the second I was fired, suddenly that became this wonderful job that I, with great people, that I missed. And there were a couple of really good people that I worked with that I missed. But with Mason Bradley, he really does love working at the Bed and Breakfast, and he loves the supernatural aspect, and he loves that dark-haired girl that got hired to be the other overnight clerk. And I mean, it's just like a perfect storm of great things about this job. Like, nobody loves the Bed and Breakfast as much as Mason does, even Mrs. Bice. And that is all due to that experience that I had at that job. And I had forgotten some of those details. And some of the characteristics that Mrs. Bice has are right out of that job and that boss that nobody liked. The HR lady was always butting heads with her. And I actually named the town where all of these stories take place after the HR lady, who had sort of taken me under her wing and said, you know, can you help me with this aspect, or, you know, with hiring? And she made me feel like a natural woman. No, like I was an asset to the company to be used, you know, that I had strengths that the actual boss did not see in me. And same year that I was fired, the HR lady had just had enough. And she came in on the boss's day off, and she cleared out the HR office of all of her stuff and emptied it out of everything that was hers. And then she put a letter of resignation on her own desk and locked the door from the inside and left the keys on the desk and then closed the door as she left. And it was days before anyone knew that she had quit because her office was locked. And the only person with the keys to the office was the HR lady and, you know, the general manager. And when I heard that story, I heard it multiple times from different people because I still kept in touch with the people that I worked with. And they all told it with such delight and relish of, you know, just a mean thing to do, to show your disrespect to a boss. Anyhow, I hope that you've enjoyed the story. I hope that you enjoy the world that this takes place in. As always, you can let me know and it will influence what I'll put on in the future. I'm not going to apologize for splitting this in two. Hopefully you feel like you got your money's worth, because they're two long episodes instead of one long episode. Two long episodes instead of one super long episode, let's put it that way. Thank you for listening all the way through, both, right? You can always support me if you want to on Patreon. I really, really appreciate it. And maybe not today, but I'm going to get to work on that Rishon Records that I mentioned in the last episode. Because if I don't, I will forget. That's how the world works, right? Don't you forget about me, folks, when you walk on by. Will you call my name? Don't. Good night.
This podcast has been produced under a Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivatives 3.0 license, granting you full access to download, share the file, listen, and delete the bugger. But you can't claim the files as your own or try to make money off them.
No doubt you noticed the fine music in this episode by one Kevin MacLeod of the website Incompetech.com, who released it under a Creative Commons license. I only wish he had a podcast so I could be listening to that instead.
I can't believe it's 10:45 and I'm yawning. I need to be beaten.
Neither of them had heard from the man who'd fathered it. Neither of them had heard from the man who'd fathered them. Neither of them had heard from the man who'd fathered them in over a decade. And then Lara noticed a necklace hanging above the mirror on Holcomb's nightstand. It was her Dije de Espíndola. It was her Dije de Espíndola.
I'm not going to say heirloom is...
No results were found. Is there a word that means heirloom? That relic? Artifact? Object. I'm going to try it all three ways. It was her Dije de Espíndola. It was her Dije de Espíndola. A particularly powerful and valuable heirloom. And valuable artifact. And valuable object. And valuable possession. I think possession is the closest.
There was the towel Shay had tossed onto the floor, and her jeans and socks still there from before. Ooh, that rhymes.
I thought she jumped into the sea, but that must have been her hoof-neat teeth. But that must have been her hoof-teeth hitting the water. But that must have been her hoof-teeth hitting the... But that must have been her hoof teeth hitting the water. I wonder how many she loses.
One very brief thing that's only semi-related is last week I got kicked off of my brother-in-law's cell phone plan. So I had to call T-Mobile and get signed up for my own plan. I had been on my sister's plan for years. Her oldest son was just old enough to maybe get a phone for himself. And she said, you know, I'm going to go in and you've been saying you need a new phone. This was also 2020. You can sign up at the same time and you can just be on my plan. And it worked great. But I had to set up my own plan and I chose the absolute cheapest, lowest tier one. Because if you're in a family bundle, the prices are lower for each person, because there are multiple people. But if you're on your own, then even the cheapest one is more than what it was in a family bundle. But because I signed up for the cheapest one, I don't have all the data that I want. So I turn off the data and only turn it on when I absolutely need it. And I have been going running for the past 3 years. And when I first started going running in 2020, I didn't have any data. I couldn't stream anything while I was running, so I would listen to music. And while I listened to music, I would think about stories, I would think about dialogue, I would think about where a book that I was working on was headed. And sometimes, only sometimes, folks, when I got back to the house, I would run in and sit down and start typing to get this stuff down that I had just thought of. Sometimes I would be excited about writing when I got home. But as soon as I got that new phone with, you know, unlimited data, I could just go to YouTube and put YouTube videos on while I was running. And that, listening to people talk, listening to stand-up, listening to reviews, listening to late-night talk shows, which is the majority of what I put on when I'm running, suddenly I was focused on listening to them. And there were no more creative sparks. There were no more, for the next 25 minutes, I'm thinking about writing, as well as thinking about not falling on my face. It's just different aspect of your brain than you use. But because now I'm on my own plan and I turn off the data, I started listening to music again. It was the exact same songs that I put on this phone in 2020 when I got it. And suddenly I started thinking about stories again, thinking about writing, thinking about dialogue, thinking about where something could go. Oh, wouldn't it be neat if I wrote a Laura and the Witch story where this happened again? It's the difference, I suppose, between listening to someone talk and just listening to music. And I'll bet if I put on classical or film score, something with no lyrics at all, it would be even stronger, the fact that your brain goes to creative places. That's neither here nor there, I realize, but it's something that I suggest to you if you do exercise, if you do go on walks or runs, to try. Rather than listening to podcasts, try just listening to music and see if it helps your creative process. Well, there you go. Hopefully, the episode is long enough now.